And welcome to The Dividing Line. Do some air guitar here. Wish I could play that well. I haven't played in ages. I did enjoy it. It was a lot of fun. But you make your choices. I don't play chess anymore. Miss chess. Should play it more often. It's good for this thing up here, what little is left of it, actually. But haven't gone shooting, and I don't know. We were going to do that. Remember? Yeah. Mm-hmm. That worked out real well, didn't it? We went once. Did we go once? I think we went once. Yeah. We were supposed to do it every month and went once. That was good. very expensive that year. That was the most expensive time ever gone shooting. Man, I could have bought thousands of rounds for what we spent for that. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Just one quick, let me mention it and then get out of the way. We'll move on to more important things. But the only thing, I mean, aside from just being sad for everyone who, for example, found Kent Hovind's materials in the past somewhat useful to them, I'm sad for all those folks seeing him just take his credibility and shoot it and stab it and bury it and do all that stuff. But the one thing in the video this morning where Kent Hovind decided that... the story keeps changing, and it's going to keep changing. But now there wasn't ever a debate, and it was a program, and now it was in the studio audience. Yeah, I know. There was a tiny little room. I know. There was no studio audience. But, the one thing that could come out of it that might be useful, and interesting, is he says Gail Ripplinger is going to do a full write-up on it. And that, everyone's telling me no video today, right? It's struggling.
We're going back to the old method. I don't know what's going on with our speed test says we're streaming great. But so YouTube, I don't know, maybe this is a really high volume time of day for YouTube live or whatever. I don't know, but we're struggling to keep our connection.
That's lovely.
Well, we are recording.
But we are recording, so that's the important part.
Yes.
So I've got a bunch of graphics today, so you may have to catch it deadcast, as we call it, or whatever. But nothing I can do about that. It had worked real well there for a while, and now all of a sudden, not working at all. But the one good thing that may come out of all of this is Gail Ripplinger is going to write up an entire story here. Now, it will be a fascinating thing to over 22 years after the event to see into the mind of Gail, interior designer Ripplinger. That will be fascinating. And especially because we actually have the recordings of what happened. And obviously Kent Hovind does not have the time. I mean, he just must be the busiest man in the world. I mean, he does not even have 46 minutes. I mean, with all the driving he does, it's only audio. Doesn't he know how to use an iPod? Put on cassette, man. I bet you somebody, you post videos. You know how to use computers. Since he hasn't had the time to actually listen to what happened, it makes me really wonder if Gail Ripplinger would actually go back and listen to that encounter from November of 1993. Huh. I was going to grab her blind guides book. I forgot to grab it. Oh, I know where it is, but don't worry about it. But it would be interesting to see what differences there are even between what she wrote within a year or two afterwards and what comes out now 22 years later. It'll be useful one way or the other. We'll be able to go, let's just compare reality documentable history with the flights of fancy. It'll be interesting. But it has reminded me that unfortunately there is a resurgence in some way of the worst forms of King James onlyism, and it's only for one reason. Anybody with a computer can now publish stuff. And it does illustrate, beyond all shadow of a doubt, the fact that most even good churches do not do much in preparing their people to know something about the history of the Bible and where it came from. And that's where this stuff comes from. And so we are going to start we'll just call this section of the program when we do it. If we were Todd Friel or something, we'd have graphics and sound effects. Do you have an echo sound effect? Not sure.
An echo sound effect?
Yes, an echo sound effect.
There you go. That's it. That's how it's done. I think I've got a coffee can in the other room.
yeah, okay. I'm going to have to turn Twitter off because everybody, the video's not working. I know. There's nothing I can do about it. Call YouTube. You know, we're sending it. They ain't distributing it. So there's nothing to be done about it. If we were Friel, we'd have all this cool stuff and we go, we call this meme theology, that type of thing. And we'd have the echo to it and it'd be really cool. We'd have music and stuff like that. But we don't have any of that stuff. So, huh? No, that's all right. Meme theology. And it does seem that that's where theology is going these days for most people, is down to the level of a meme. And what I mean by that is I have 1, 2, 3, 4, I have 5 memes queued up here that I've pulled from Facebook that I'm going to be using as illustrations and responding to them. Unfortunately, to respond meaningfully requires more than just another meme. I am reminded once again of the wise words of Douglas Wilson in response to the young lady when he said, "I often have thoughts that require more than one sentence to express them." There is more than a small amount of condescension hidden into the tonal qualities of Brother Wilson's comment at that point. but it's true. It is true. And when we're talking about the history of the Bible, textual transmission, things like that, often requires more than a single sentence to express the truth. Let's bring the first example of meme theology up on the screen, if we could. There we go. It's one of the King James versus NIV. I love the Micah especially loves. Micah wishes he could do graphic design like King James only people do, because all of them are just really these letterbox things.
Sometimes you wonder if somebody didn't, you know, still get the magazine out and cut letters.
Yeah, well, it does look like it's from the 1990s.
Yes.
That does seem to be the thing. So anyway, here is King James verse NIV, Mark 10:21, King James, "And come, take up the cross and follow me." NIV, "Then come, follow me." And then, of course, the bottom of all these two that we're looking at. "They told me all Bibles were the same." There was this, I forget which one I grabbed this from, but one of the many, 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 many King James only folks on Facebook. So if we can minimize that, let me see how, is it still? Yeah, you can still see that. It's big enough to figure out. Okay. What I want to do with, I'll probably have to switch back and forth now I think about it. Just to be able to give you this information. And there's just no way with what I'm looking at here. Let me show you what I'm looking at when I look at... Why are you doing that to me? Oh, I see why. Never mind. When I'm looking at what I have in accordance, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 normal tabs in my regular accordance desktop setup. The third one over here is called New Testament Textual. Why don't we go ahead and make that bigger? Nobody can see any of that. So there we go. So here's the third. I have JRW Main, which is my main, normally New Testament text setup. I have the Synoptics, which is blank right now because I don't have a particular reference in there. The New Testament Textual tab, the Textual Interlinear tab, which places your text into a interlinear form to where you can see sort of how it's, like here's Greek New Testament, the TR, Westcott, Hort, Byzantine, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Washingtonianus, and Alexandrinus, and what each one of them has in that particular text, so on and so forth. So that's pretty cool. And then you've got your New Testament manuscripts pane right here. So I've got Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, Washingtonianus, Alexandrinus, and then if the papyri cover that, which do not at Mark 10:21, Mark does not have a whole lot in the way of papyri evidence to it. And then I have an Old Testament text frame where I basically have the NASB, the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia, the Rawls LXX, and then I've got the Beal Carson New Testament Use of the Old Testament, which normally I end up doing that, but it is a useful resource to have. I do have an excellent accordance library and an excellent Logos library, and sometimes you end up with things in both, actually. Anyways, we go back here to New Testament textual. Here's Mark 10:21, and what I'm just going to have to do is I'm going to have to take the textual commentaries out and then blow up the text so that it's actually visible on the screen. There we go. So what is in the graphic that we just saw that someone posted on Facebook is in reference to let me see here. 10:21, and it's right here. There is what is in the NIV, and then come, follow me. And then you have this little thing right here. All right? Oh, I didn't want to do that, though that's sort of interesting. It does that. Here is the textual marker indicating insertion of text after moi right here. And when you go over to the apparatus, here's that same symbol right there. Why does it keep turning this thing on? I can't find a way to take that out of my startup routine. I need to. Here's the insertion. Take up the cross. Washingtonianus, family 13, a few others have take up your cross. Interesting that the earliest exemplar of the Byzantine text has you, take up your cross, the cross of you. But take up the cross is found in Alexandrinus, Washingtonianus with that addition. Families 1, 13, 25, 2, it is the majority reading. Whenever you see this right here, that's the majority reading. And then you have other translations like the Syriac, Sahidic, Baharic. And then you have the double dashed line, and after that, the text. So the text without that insertion is Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, C, D, interestingly enough, Delta, Theta, Psi, 0274, 565, 579, 892, 2427, a few others, Old Latin, certain manuscripts of the Sahidic, so Sahidic. Notice it says SAMS and SAMSS. There's more Sahidic manuscripts that have it than do not, but it's a split. Baharic, and then you get into your patristic citations like Clement and so on and so forth, which this is actually the NA27 apparatus. I'm not sure why I don't have the NA28 up, but that's what popped up. I wonder where Well, let's go with that for now. It's good enough. So, oh, I know. That's because it's on my other computer. Never mind. I've updated things on the other computer, but not on this. So, here's your textual evidence. And what you'll notice is right here. 8:34. Mark 8:34. Well, what's Mark 8:34? Well, here's Mark 8:34. And in Mark 8:34, Jesus, of course, is saying to the disciples, if you wish to follow after me, deny yourselves and take up the cross, take up his cross, actually. He must deny himself, take up the cross, his cross, and follow after me. And so the indication in the textual data here is that this phrase has been borrowed from Mark 8:34 and inserted in some later manuscripts, and Alexandrinus being Byzantine in the Gospels, so primarily the Byzantine manuscript tradition, at Mark 10:21. That could have been done purposefully. It could have been done just simply because someone knew Mark 8:34 so well, take up the very phrase, take up, follow after, invoke the concept of my cross, and so it was done inadvertently by the scribe who maybe wasn't paying attention, was going from memory. Even a person reading could possibly make that kind of mistake. There are various possibilities. Now, what this leads us to is the whole discussion, which we've had in the past. I'm not going to repeat it right now. The whole discussion of what weight you give to manuscripts. We can go ahead and minimize that. What weight you give to manuscripts and the issue of accepting a minority reading over a majority reading. We've done the New Testament reliability presentation. We've discussed textual criticism on the program before. You certainly can go back and find those things in the archives. But the vast majority of believing Christian scholars believe that manuscripts that are the earliest carry the most weight. It's not a matter of just counting manuscripts, because if it was just a matter of counting manuscripts, then two things a couple things would follow. The original readings of the manuscript tradition were primarily limited to one location. To those that would underlie the eventual Byzantine manuscript tradition. And that methodology would give you a different majority text depending on what century you're in. Now, one of the ways it's been used to get around this is that various sundry folks who have promoted a majority or Byzantine priority position would say that manuscripts wore out over time. That manuscripts in certain locations were more likely to destruction than the dry desert climate, and so it gives a unfair geographical advantage, so on and so forth. The reality is it's incredibly complex to try to recreate the history of the transmission of the text over time. You know, it would be a whole lot easier today with the ability to have meteorological readings and, the kind of recording devices and things we have today. But we didn't have any of that in the ancient world. And so you had wars and famines and floods and fires and all sorts of things. And so very often we don't even know where a manuscript came from. We can speculate that it came from Egypt or Caesarea or whatever. The fact is, we don't know. And so you do have a whole lot of speculation, shall we say. The vast majority of believing scholars do not count manuscripts in the sense of, 487 read this way, 27 read this way, so obviously the 487 wins. given that the vast majority of manuscripts come from after 1000 AD, that kind of methodology ignores the reality of the history of the transmission of the text. And so when you have the kind of evidence that you have in Mark 10:21, coupled with the appearance of the phrase elsewhere, and by the way, I didn't show this to you, but if the idea is that there's a conspiracy going on, and the NIV is trying to hide the call to discipleship and hide the call to take up the cross and so on and so forth, and I didn't bother looking, but I can guarantee you that you can find sermons from King James only advocates specifically stating that that's what's going on. No doubt about it whatsoever. But the fact of the matter is, the NIV says, take up your cross and follow me at Mark 8:34. So the call to take up the cross is right there. It's right in front of us. That's sort of important. And very rarely addressed. I guess the theory would be, well, they couldn't take it out all the time, because then we might catch on to them. But there is strong evidence that Mark 10:21 is an addition. And what's important is to recognize that we have sufficient evidence upon which to discuss the issue. If we only had one manuscript, if we only had two manuscripts, this would be extremely difficult to even begin to address these issues. But we have an entire manuscript tradition that allows us to do things differently. Now, I'll pause. Oh, I can't do that and change it. That's interesting. Let's go back to preview and try to find that one. Let's see what that one is now. So this is the only problem with this. Can you bring it up? Yep, there it is. Here is another one. Let's get it large enough so people can see it. This is the famous bloodless Bible text that I told the story of this in the King James Only controversy. All of these texts, by the way, I addressed 22 years ago in the King James Only controversy. So if you want to read further on the subjects, you can find them in the book. This is one that bothers people on an emotional level. In whom we have redemption through his blood, in whom we simply have redemption, not through his blood, at Colossians 1:14. And again, I can guarantee you there are numerous sermons out there speaking about the horrific modern translations that remove the blood of Christ and are scandalized by the blood of Christ and everything else. Of course, the reason that the NIV or the NASB or the ESV does not have through his blood here is because the Greek version that they are, the Greek text that they are translating, does not contain it. And there is a very good reason why that is the case. And that is, you can see it right here if we blow that up. And here is, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. There's our insertion mark right there. That's interesting. On my screen, the cursor is much larger than it is on that screen. That's weird. Huh. So I'll have to move it around more. But see, there you can see it there. But wow, that's really weird. Anyway, there's the insertion mark. Here's the insertion mark here. And once again, we have a text which indicates this is a what's called a parallel corruption, a scribe familiar with a parallel text inserting it. Here is Diatu Haimatasautu via through by means of his blood. 1, 2, 3, 4 Greek manuscripts grand total. Earliest is the 9th century. Clementine Vulgate, Heraclean Syriac, Cassiodorus. And that's it. Now, keep something in mind. In the last variant, the majority of texts went against the modern translations. And as we're going to see in a moment, very often King James-only advocates will trumpet the problematic nature of the minority text. They're saying, you're going with the minority of the manuscripts. You should go with the majority of the manuscripts. Okay, there are those that, you know, there are majority text advocates. But in this case, you're looking at the small minority underlying the King James Version. Four predominantly irrelevant texts. Minuscules all from no earlier than the 9th century. And in light of the fact that the exact phrase appears in the parallel of Ephesians 1:7, and notice, in whom, blow it up there, in whom we have the redemption, diatu haimatas autu, through his blood, the forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace, Ephesians 1:7. It's there in the NIV. It's there in all modern translations. No one's trying to hide anything about the blood of Christ. There's no being scandalized. None of the common stuff you hear King James only advocates preaching about and screaming about. It's right there. So Ephesians 1:7 and Colossians 1:14 are parallel passages. And over and over and over again, I wonder if I have it. Yeah, it's down there. I'm not going to reach all the way down there to get it. But if you would take the time to look at the textual apparatus, the bottom of the UBS synopsis, the Quattuor Evangeliorum, the four gospel parallel, which is what I've been preaching through for, well, teaching through for years in our Sunday school. Over and over and over again, when you have close parallel texts between the Gospels, you'll find some scribes somewhere that decide to try to harmonize things. They decided that they wanted Matthew to say it the way that Mark did, or Mark say it the way that Matthew did, or make them all photocopies of each other, which would make them useless. And so parallel corruption is a very, very common thing to find in the Gospels, but there are other places where there are parallels. This is one of them, Colossians and Ephesians. And so you have the exact same terminology, and in all probability, not purposefully, but inadvertently, because of memorization of Ephesians 1:7, maybe the utilization of it in the liturgy of the church, whatever, you have the insertion of this phrase into Colossians where it was not originally. If you're going to argue that that was there originally, you're going to have to say that pretty much everybody in the first 1,000 years of the church sort of forgot about it, or at least first 500 years, minimally. And that only later did it somehow pop back in some strange and miraculous fashion. And there would be King James only folks. Believe me, there's always a way. As long as consistency of argumentation means nothing to you, there is no position in the world you cannot argue for. Easily done. Easily done. But the important thing to realize is if you used the majority text argument before, then you should reject Colossians 1:14. Because that's not the majority text. In fact, I have the majority text right here. Well, actually, I probably have the majority of text in accordance, too. But it's more fun to look it up in this. So, Galatians, Colossians 1:14. in whom we have the redemption, the forgiveness of sins. There is a note. The note does tell you through his blood. And it says majority text part. Yeah, four texts and TR. But it's not a part of the actual text in the majority text by Hodges and Farstead. And there's a reason for that. So consistency becomes the issue. And I have said for a very, very, very long time, the hallmark of King James onlyism is inconsistency. The standards that you apply to the King James are completely different than the standards you will apply to everything else. No King James onlyist can apply the same standards as the King James they apply to every other translation. They can't do it. Because presuppositionally, they have embraced the King James as their final authority. So that's just all there is. So you have a minority reading here, small, late minority reading, that made its way into the Textus Receptus, reflected in whatever text Erasmus had available to him. And that's why it's there. That's why it's there. Now, let me give you another example of this. And that will be this one here. Let me see if I can bring that one up. What you got now? There we go. Now this is King James only graphics, the best of King James only graphics. This is the best of King James only graphics. And King James Version, now this fellow, Luke Lefebvre, I made the interesting decision when I grabbed these and I reposted them to my feed and said, I'm going to talk about some of these things. I made the decision of dropping him a message on Facebook. Why was he excited that I had done that? He wanted to have a lengthy discussion about his interesting take on propitiation. That's what he wanted to do. And so it was interesting. And I also mentioned to him that I noticed he had made the assertion that Son of Man refers to the human nature of Christ, Son of God, the divine nature of Christ. I said, you really, no, that's wrong. And so now, because I messaged him that, and we had that brief conversation, now he just wants to talk to me all the time on Facebook. But anyway, Luke 2:33, again, all of these texts thoroughly discussed two decades ago in the King James Only controversy. But here again, the issue is the matter of what it means. Joseph and his mother marveled, or his father and his mother marveled. So this is verses 33 and 43 that are used here. Since it's in the book, I'm not interested in going through all that. Gone through this many times before. What I want you to see is the form of argumentation. The form of argumentation. Notice it says, the reading found in the King James Bible in Luke 2:33 is that of the majority of all Greek manuscripts, including A, E, G, H, K, M, S, U, Y, X, Psi, Gamma, Delta, Theta, Lambda, Pi, Psi, and Omega. It is also the reading of the old Latin copies, and so on and so forth. Likewise, the reading of the Syriac, Peshitta, Heraclean, and some Coptic, Boharic versions, and the Gothic ancient translations. So it goes on and on and on, and what's the argument? This is the majority reading, and it is. And so there's the standard, majority reading. You go with the majority reading, right? Well, here's the problem. Why don't we blow this one up? Now, I got to read this, especially because some of you again, we recognize YouTube has abandoned us yet once again. But we're recording this time, so you'll be able to watch this, just not live. Revelation 16:5. Now, why would anybody be addressing this? Because I have addressed this, and I have made the very strong argument that Revelation 16:5 truly gives the lie to so much King James-only argumentation. And it does. It really does. Revelation 16:5, King James says, "Thou art righteous, O Lord, which art and wast and shalt be, because thou hast judged thus." Modern translation says, "Just you are, O Holy One, who is and who was, for you brought these judgments." So the difference is between "O Holy One" and "shalt be." It's the difference between Hahasios, Holy One, and Esamenos, which means "shalt be." Now, what the King James Only movement has had to try to do was deal with the fact that I have documented very plainly that this came into the Textus Receptus via Beza. Erasmus didn't have it. I didn't get it out, but Stephanus doesn't have it. This is Beza's doing, Calvin's successor, Geneva. Now that really bugs him. I'm good. So many of these King James only guys are rabidly anti-Catholic, just foaming at the mouth anti-Catholic. You know, they wake up in the middle of the night going, "Surveyed us!" I mean, that kind of anti-Calvinist. Sorry, did I say anti-Catholic? Well, they're anti-Catholic too. Anti-Calvinist. Sorry, anti-Calvinist. And they're just, yeah, well, that too. They just, ooh. So Beza, Calvin's successor, this came from a Calvinist? Oh, how can this be? But since we put it, and notice it even says, it's sort of hard to see because of the background, but James White and Revelation 16:5. It's right, well, where'd it go? Oh, there it is. Yeah, right there. There's James White and Revelation 16:5. Again, Micah just wishes he could do graphics like this. Beza's conjectural emendation. Now, there's no question that this is where it came from. The 1598 Beza was one of the texts. They had the five Erasmus, the 1550 Stephanus, and the 1598 Beza. This is the text that they use. This is acknowledged. This is history. So which one had this reading? Beza did. They went with that. All right. So what are they going to do? Well, this is one of the most amazing examples of straining at the gnat. Listen to what's here. Beza's conjectural emendation. There are two Latin commentaries with readings of Revelation 16:5 which agree with Beza in referring to the future aspect of God and shalt be. Beatus of Libana and Haimo Halberstattensis, a German bishop in the 9th century, wrote a commentary on the book of Revelation titled Commentaria in Apocalypsen. So you have two Latin commentaries, allegedly. And then listen to this. There are at least two Greek fathers who used the phrase to a person of the Godhead. Christ in Revelation is also referred to as Ha Erkamenos, Revelation 1:4, 1:8, 4:8, 11:17. What does any of this have to do with what the original reading of Revelation 16:5 was? From any meaningful perspective, zip. Nothing. Nothing at all. It is purely throwing dust in the air. Then, notice, Clement of Alexandria referred to God as Ha Esamenos, who is to come. Woo! And Gregory of Nyssa referred to Christ as Ha Esamenos in On the Baptism of Christ. Can you imagine what these people would be doing if we made a change in the King James and used this kind of argumentation? Well, you know, there's a guy about 1,700 years ago used this word in something completely different. And so we should change King James Bible. Yeah, they buy it for a second. They just, All right, let's rip that out there. Betsy, let's start writing a new page here for the King James Bible. That's what we do right now. Desperation. I mean, this is desperation. And then what you can't see is, look over here on the side. You can barely see this, but it says summary. See here, summary. Which art and wast and shalt be completes a formula. Oh, so it's a formula. See. Beatus's excerpt mentions the future aspect of God. Oh, there's a future aspect of God. Haimo alluded to this formula. Copies of Revelation were extensively corrupted very early. Bruce Metzger approved the use of conjectural emendations in principle. Not here, but in principle, huh? There is rabbinical and Greek authority for Beza's conjectural tractatic formula. We won't tell you what it is, but it's there. There are only four witnesses of Revelation 16:5 prior to the 10th century. Well, that's important. Sinaiticus has confirmable examples of a scribe confusing similar-looking words. I mean, listen to this. This is, to me, one of the greatest examples I've ever seen. Congratulations to Luke. I don't think he came up with this. He got this from somebody else. I'd be interested in knowing where it is. But this is the most concentrated effort I've ever seen of anyone to try to get around to what I document in the King James Only controversy. And this is what I love, because this is the biggest example of abject desperation I've ever seen. There is not a single person on that side of this argument that would ever give a picogram of weight to this kind of argumentation if it were used against the King James reading. They would laugh at it, and rightfully so. Rightfully so. This is someone who understands the weight of the evidence and is doing everything in their power to get around it. They don't care what the evidence is. They have one job: defend the King James reading. That's all you're going to do. One job. So you can come up with anything, no matter how abjectly and absurdly irrelevant. Throw the dust, throw the dirt. For most of our followers, it will be enough, because they're not concerned about consistent application of standards of textual criticism or anything else. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. But what I want you now to think about is how abjectly contradictory it is to the preceding graphic we looked at. Remember the preceding graphic? Let me show it to you here. What was the whole argument here? It's the majority reading. Majority of all Greek manuscripts, A, E, G, H, K, blah, 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 blah. That's what we should have at Luke 2:33. But when we move over here to the other one, when we move over here to Revelation 16:5, yeah, actually, all the Greek manuscripts we possess of Revelation 16:5 say the same thing. But we will throw all of that right out the window. Why? Because we're not arguing from the facts. We have a position, and it's the King James. That's just the way it is. So we'll go with it. And we'll just throw stuff up in the air and just dust and dirt everywhere, just try to obscure the fact that we don't have any basis, none, for taking the reading that we're taking, but it's what's in the King James. So that's what we'll defend. There you go. Man, is it quarter to four? No, it's not. You messed with my computer in here. There is no way that covering only four of those little things has taken me 45 minutes. Well, you know we're going jumbo anyways, right? Well, we got to go jumbo. Got to go jumbo. Anyway, and have we pretty much given up on YouTube? Oh, you disconnected. Great. All right. Well, wonderful. Have you tweeted out listen audio, and then we'll you need to let the Twitter audience is all really sad and depressed. So
yeah, I have no words at the moment. I just, you know.
Okay.
I kept trying to connect, and it'd last for about 30 seconds and then start failing again. And it's like, if I keep doing this, it's going to mess up the recording again, and I don't want that to
happen. That's true. That's so true. We don't want that to happen. Okay. All right. Let's shift gears quickly. I did mention to a Muslim, Rudolf Bischoff posted a picture of some books he was reading, and a couple Muslims decided to jump on. By the way, did you see the Yahya Snow video accusing me of bigotry? You know what it was? He accused a bunch of people of bigotry. All it was Jay Smith and I both sort of noticed the same thing, and that is, and this is just fact. This isn't bigotry. This is a fact. Middle Eastern people argue differently than Londoners. For Middle Eastern people, the volume of your voice is directly relevant to the confidence you have in expressing it. And things that we Westerners do not find at all convincing, a lot of Middle Easterners do find convincing. And not because it's logical, but because it is part of the argumentation. And that's not bigotry. That's observation of absolute fact. No one who's ever, I mean, everyone has seen it. It's obvious. Yahya's no. I believe Yahya's purpose in life is to just simply muddy the waters and try to keep any meaningful conversation from happening between serious Christians and serious Muslims. I really do. They watch this program. Hi, Yahya. How you doing? I don't know why you do what you're doing, but I really do not have any respect for what you do. Really find it. If you want bigotry, I think that anyway. He jumped in on Rudolph's post, and then this one guy just started dropping a bunch of stuff, all these memes, Muslim memes, on what he had posted. So I grabbed just one, and I tried to challenge him on it, and it became very obvious when he responded that he does not speak English. So that was worthless. But here's the meme. You should have it. Okay. Let's bring it up here. There we go. Jesus said, "And indeed, Allah is my Lord and your Lord, so worship him. That is the straight path." Quran 19:36. That's sort of Maryam, Ayah 36. And so I'm seeing more and more of these things on Facebook. And so here's my challenge to my serious Muslim friends. And obviously you guys watch, because you put stuff up, you know, a day or two after it's been posted. So you're watching. That's good. I'm glad you are. Yahya, I'm even glad you are. It just frightens me to think that. Oh, by the way, and you know where he pulled it from? This is the amazing thing. It's from my criticism of Waleed Shobat. I was saying Waleed Shobat thinks that these long tirades mean something. And so here I am, and in essence, I'm criticizing one of the people who are pushing for Christian jihadism and crusaderism, and he has the gall. Sorry, Yahya, it's gall to pull from that and say, I'm the bigot. Wow. I'm just like, phew. You don't get much lower than that. You really don't. That's another Ahmed move on that one. Wow, that was bad. Anyway, I'm seeing these things on Facebook, and so here's my challenge to my serious Muslim friends. Suggest to me, demonstrate to me, a consistent worldview and methodology of doing historical criticism of our texts that would allow you to substantiate what that meme says. And it specifically says, Jesus said. So you are making the claim that the words recorded in Surah 19 were said by Jesus. Now, let me just point a couple things out. A, this is got to be a translation of what Jesus said, right? Who did the translation? Jesus didn't speak Arabic. So you all like to say, well, the Greek's a translation of what Jesus said. I'm reading a book right now on whether Jesus spoke Greek. And it's quite interesting. Strong criticism of the Aramaic hypothesis. Not done with it yet, but there's a lot to look at. Because it was just sort of a given in my seminary years. Well, I'm learning more and more that you've got to look at what's a given in those situations. But let's say it was Aramaic. There are a couple places where very obviously, do you really think, ever thought about this one? Do you really think Jesus was speaking to Pilate in Aramaic? You think Pilate spoke Aramaic? Pilate would have spoken two languages, Latin and what? Greek. So given how massive the evidence has become of the predominance of Koine Greek in the homeland of Jesus at the time of Jesus' life, do you really think he didn't know it? What do you think he was doing talking to Pilate? How about the, remember the woman, the Gentile woman who followed after Jesus? You know, even the dogs eat the crumbs at the table. Remember her? You think he was, what language do you think he was talking to her in? Anyway, just something to think about. Here's the problem. You only have this in Arabic. So who translated? Is this God's translation? And what evidence do you have that Jesus ever said these words? Because you see, now, if you're a Muslim who does not believe that the actual words of the Torah and Injil have been corrupted, then you're in at least a little more consistent or safe position. If you're not telling me that my Bible's been changed, I'm just misinterpreting it, then this really isn't a challenge to you. But there are almost none of those Muslims left. That was a position that was quite common in the past. Not so much today, ever since Itzhar al-Haq. But anyway, if you are amongst the 99.9% of Muslims who, for example, we reviewed Adnan Rashid Hamza Tsortzi's video a couple weeks ago on the alleged corruption of the Bible. All right, so if you're in that group, then if you accept the argumentation of modern liberal scholarship that we cannot know that what Mark recorded Jesus is saying is what Mark actually said. It's too far removed. There was all this time. Oral tradition get changed. And yet, no one seriously argues that Mark is not a first century document. And nobody seriously argues that it wasn't written in the exact language that Jesus would have been speaking, or at least would have been prominent in that day. But if you say, well, we can't really know, if you reject historically, if you use a historical critical methodology that allows you to reject what Mark says, then tell me how you can believe that this is true. Because there is no historical connection whatsoever between the days of Jesus and the early 7th century when these words were eventually written down. Well, you know, if we take even the most conservative Islamic concept under Abu Bakr, dictated by Muhammad, even if you accept that, it's still the early 7th century. Where's the evidence? Where's where are the manuscripts? Where are the citations? Where are the quotations? There isn't any. You know that. There's nothing in the 6th century. There's nothing in the 5th century. There's nothing in the 4th, 3rd, 2nd, 1st. There's just nothing there. You believe what's in the Quran because you believe the Quran's scripture. If we say we believe what's in the New Testament because we believe the New Testament scripture, then we don't have any place to go, do we? Except for one thing. Ours comes before yours. And if ours is scripture, then yours ain't. And yours tells us to judge by what's in ours. Surah 5, 47, 48. So show me a consistent historical critical methodology that would allow you to say what's in this meme. Jesus said these words. That would not, in the exact same way, confirm that Jesus also said what's found in Mark chapter 14 when at his trial, when Jesus is implored by the high priest, are you the son of the most blessed one? His response was, I am. And then he conflated Psalm 110 and Daniel 7, 14. Put them together to indicate that he was the divine Son of Man who was given dominion, power, glory, authority, servants who worship him and who sits at the right hand of Yahweh, resulting in the high priest tearing his robes and saying, you've heard the blasphemy, deserves death. You show me a consistent methodology that would substantiate Surah 19 while allowing you to criticize what's in the New Testament. I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it. I've never seen it. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't think you can do it. But those of you who are truly serious, who actually believe that what you believe is true, that's my challenge to you. And if you can't come up with one, will you at least admit the reality of the fact that you can't? That you do use double standards? You use uneven scales? You have to. It's the nature of your faith that you have to use a standard in defense of your position that you cannot use in criticizing others. That's a problem. That is a problem. Okay, all right. There's some meme theology. How's you like the meme theology? Did you like meme theology, Rich? You like meme theology? All right. I do need to mention that on the program today, there's some more spices in the tea bags I have. They're a little spicier. I'm not sure what the spices are. There's some sort of citrus or something in it. But this is good rooibos tea. And it came from, Rich is a bit of a geek. So am I, for that matter. What's the thing called?
It's called a Keurig.
Keurig. So Rich got rooibos tea for the Keurig. And you just stick it in there and boom. It does take a little of the magic out, you know, the dragging, you know, dumping the tea bag and the
constantly waiting for the water to boil, well, which it never does. Yeah, yeah. And
that's true.
And the mess that the bag makes.
Yeah, that stuff, yeah.
You know, and of course, I can make my coffee and you can make your tea out of the same machine.
That's absolutely incredible.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. It is truly amazing. All right, let's get back to this video because I'm falling behind on everything and everybody knows it. For those of you who have forgotten, we were responding to the Simply Sira video. And I actually only have 3 minutes left in it. But I did want to mention something. And that is that some others who will remain nameless simply because we don't want to get them in trouble. Someone pointed out to me, and this does illustrate the differences in emphasis and what you hear, even between Christians who are seeking to reach out to Muslims. I have noted, I don't know if I'd call it a shift. I don't know exactly what it is. But, for example, in my debate with Yusuf Ismail in South Africa, Yusuf took a position on the nature of the Quran that somewhat surprised me. Because I was pressing him on the nature of the Quran and whether it really is, you know, whether it was written on the heavenly tablet, whether it has eternally existed, not just in the way that, you know, if you affirm God has eternal knowledge of all of his actions, that would be insufficient to be the great controversy of the first few centuries of Islamic history. The idea that the Quran is uncreated is not just that it's a reflection of the knowledge of God. It goes beyond that. And when I was pushing Yusuf on the fact that that the same incident is narrated in different ways, the same words expressed in different phraseology, I was surprised to find that he was willing to create wiggle room for himself in the sense of viewing the Quran in ways that I don't think would be overly well accepted in certain lands like Afghanistan, maybe even Pakistan, certain parts of Pakistan under the Taliban, certainly under ISIS rule. These would not be accepted. And in this video, even though the focus for me, again, was this strange Jesus Quran thing, which I know that missionaries have used Jesus as the word. I get it. But as a theologian, I'm not making parallels between the incarnate word and some written document that comes 600 years later. Not going there, no matter how dramatic that might be for someone, not going to go there. So, in other words, what I'm saying is, this video represents one particular take, and not necessarily a take that would go over really well in another world, the Islamic world. But I haven't really been focusing upon that. My concern is primarily what it's saying about Jesus and the argumentation that it's making about Jesus. But if you really wanted to be extremely thorough, what you would do is you would also criticize it in regard to its perspectives on Islamic theology as well. And it does seem that these folks are not quite as conservative as a lot of the folks that engage in dawah. So, we were looking at, they had just quoted from John 5:19. I tell you the truth, the Son can do nothing by himself. He does only what he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son also does. And remember, they're referring to a graphic. I'm going to see if I can find it here real quick. Yeah, right here. Throw this up so people could see it. That man and God are different from one another. And there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the hypostatic union that is being represented in the film. Not understanding that we're not saying that, you know, they rightly 100% God, 100% man, but don't seem to understand what that would then mean. Because then the criticism they offer is of something other than that, which is a bit of a problem. So, let's go back here to and pick it up right at this point, which is left off.
Father does, the Son also does. This would mean that Jesus was dependent on someone else, and therefore weak.
Now, I just stop it in a... I wonder what nation that flag is from. weak? Why do you say that? Again, the presupposition, the assumption is that if the Son voluntarily takes on human flesh and then acts in perfect harmony with the Father, that makes him weak? Or does that simply mean that God can engage in self-control of his own power? Does God have to act with omnipotence in every situation? That's like asking, if God makes it rain, does have to flood the earth? Or can God control the power of that rain so that you have that beautiful summertime or wintertime, not let's try it one more time, springtime rain that is actually sort of fun to walk in? Obviously, the answer to that's fairly clear, but I don't see how that follows if someone's weak.
And then take, for instance, when Jesus said, "But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father."
Now again, we've covered this dozens of times, but if you're going to talk to Muslims, vast majority of them have never read the surrounding context, but they know this one verse. It's like talking to Mormons who've only read James 2:20. And if they were consistent, they would have to say Jesus never said these words. Never said these words. Because he refers to God as Father. He refers to himself as Son. And according to the Quran, no prophet would identify himself in this way. So they focus upon this text and the supposed inherent ignorance of Jesus, even though they don't believe that Jesus would ever have said it. And they don't see that if they do use it this way, then Jesus is placing himself above men. No one knows. Not even the angels of heaven. Above the angels. Nor even the Son. So the Son is between the angels and the Father. Won't accept that either because the Quran says he's a mere Rasul. So keeping those things in mind and remembering that they think this indicates an inherent ignorance on Jesus' part. Why do I use the term inherent? That it was necessary by his nature. I say it was necessary by his function. What do I mean by that? Well, I've used the illustration many times. There were certain aspects of Jesus' divine nature that had to be veiled so that he might function the way that he and the Father and the Spirit had chosen for him to function, and that he had chosen to enter into that role voluntarily. He made himself of no reputation, he humbled himself, etc., etc. So, for Jesus to be able to bring out the many important theological truths that came forth from his encounters with the Jews, he could not have maintained the glorious state that he had pre-incarnate. If Jesus had walked through the streets of Jerusalem shining as brightly as he did on the Mount of Transfiguration, who would have debated him? Would the Pharisees have tried to trap him? Would we have the discussion with the Sadducees about the resurrection that teaches us so much about these things? No, of course not. They saw a regular man. So a regular man had to be before them. And so the brilliance of his glory had to be veiled. He could not walk down a dark street and not need a lamp to see by, simply because he glowed. Now, this one text, now we know that he had miraculous knowledge. We know that he knew it was then. But it seems that you could make an argument that he did so by the power of the Spirit to demonstrate the unity of Father, Son, and Spirit in the ministry and then to act as our example as Christians, as believers, as those who follow today, I think you can make a pretty good argument that Jesus was dependent upon the Holy Spirit for these things. And so what you would have here is a veiling of divine knowledge, a non-inquiry of the Holy Spirit into looking for, into revealing this particular aspect of divine knowledge, all so that he could function and interact with his disciples and the rest of the world in the way that the triune God had determined he needed to do so, to give us the word, the teachings, to accomplish his ministry as the Messiah. Now, why would that be necessary? I don't know why it would be necessary. But that's what he says. And the emphasis is not upon his ignorance. In fact, this is a very highly exalted Son. But the emphasis is upon the Father's particular control of this aspect of his creation. That he is the one who sets that hour and no one else. No one else. And in fact, I think you could argue that to know here is not just simply to... It could be understood as not just being having factual knowledge, but determining what the content of that factual knowledge would be. If so, then it would be referring to the fact that it's the Father and the Father alone that has set that final time. But anyways, all of that sadly never enters into the thought process of 99% of our Muslim friends, because they don't believe Jesus said these things and they don't study it in its context or anything along those lines either. Implying.
This would mean that Jesus' knowledge was not all-encompassing, and therefore he was ignorant of something. And finally, we look at Colossians 2:9.
Now, this is fascinating to me. This is fascinating to me. Because this is without a doubt one of the most important texts teaching the deity of Christ in all the New Testament. And their take on it's fascinating.
Describes clearly Jesus' nature, stating, "And in him, i.e. Jesus, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form." And of course, this would mean that Jesus then experienced manhood in all its shame and glory, which includes eating, which signifies dependency, sleeping, which signifies vulnerability and weakness, and of course, relieving oneself, which signifies impurity.
So, this is the standard. The thankfully, Abdullah Kunda put it on a higher level. But this is the standard Muslim idea. God could never become man because he would have had to have used the restroom. And by our rules, that's impurity. And therefore, there you go. How you get that at Colossians 2:9, I don't know, because if you were to actually interpret some level of seriousness, you would recognize that it's referring to Jesus post-resurrection. It's saying, "For in him is dwelling," hati enatoi katoi kai, present tense, panta pleromates theate ta somatikos, in his dwelling all the fullness of deity in bodily form. It was an anti-Gnostic argument. It was an argument that which makes God God, theatetos, was at that time, as resurrected, dwelling in Jesus in form. Now, I don't know. I've never asked a Muslim whether they think that in the resurrection they'll need to use the restroom, but I sort of doubt that they would say that. And so it's a really dumb argument about Jesus in his exalted state. So, but again, I almost said we can't expect our Muslim friends to interpret the Bible in that way, but I stopped and said, no. When I look at the Quran, I try to make sure that I'm not making that kind of blunder. I try to read the context. I can tell the difference between perfect and imperfect verbs in Arabic. And even if you can't read Greek, there's plenty of online stuff, plenty of programs. I mean, I'm always looking for better Quran programs. I can show you a program online right now. Excellent website that if you have not gotten to it, you need to bookmark this thing. Right here. And let's go to Surah 517. How's that? Just for the fun of it. Go and let me give you, I'm not sure if it's going to show it. No, I have to go to here, there, and then back to Window, and then back to Safari, and there it is. Good habit. This is corpus.quran.com. And so, you know, here's Surah 517. And so it has each, you know, they have certainly disbelieved. Kafara, verb, third person, masculine, singular, perfect verb. Kafar, the kafirs in the substantival form, but that's kafara, disbelieved. Those who, kulu, have said, Allah, huwa, la masihu, Ibn Maryam, that Allah is Messiah, son of Mary, which is not what Christians would ever really say. Anyways, but the point is, it's all parsed out for you, so on and so forth. Very good resource if you want to track that down and utilize that. But I think I've mentioned before, I wish I could show it to you. I'd have to actually just bring my iPad in and hold it up like this to you. But the best program I've found, the closest to what we would have, Cordance, Bible Works, Logos, Olive Tree, is called My Quran. I think it's all of $6, which for a app is up there a bit, but I think it's all of $6. And you know, exhaustive concordance, roots, all sorts of stuff. It's definitely worth getting if you're wanting to look for that kind of material. Let's see here. Should have the video back. So anyway, missed Colossians 2:9 there really, really badly, but we go on.
Which brings us to our final checkbox. And of course, as stated before, these things are completely contrary to God's true nature. Now, Christian apologists might say, well, isn't the Quran considered God's word, which means an attribute of Him is also dwelling in an impure earth? Our answer is again that the Quran is a reflection of God's word. God does not exist.
Now, this is a problem. You know, I'll leave it to them to fight it out amongst themselves, but there's this idea of really a reflection of something that's not really here is not what the Quran says about itself. The Quran says it has been sent down, not it's not been reflected from something that's not here. But this isn't relevant because they've totally missed the concept of the hypostatic union, reality of a perfect human nature, so that It's total disconnect all the way along.
Physically inside each and every Quran. So when Muslims burn the Quran to dispose of it, for instance, they are not essentially burning a piece of God. Whereas Christians believe that in Jesus, God, or a part of God, became fully united with the flesh of man, and that...
Fully united in the hypostatic union. So that He is the Lord of glory who could be crucified. But it's not like He ceased being God. And it's not like the man was impure. God can create that perfect human nature.
Two became one and the same. So when Jesus was crucified, that was, according to the Christian doctrine, literally God who was there experiencing the crucifixion.
Now, of course, they put up the standard text, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, not understanding the quotation of Psalm 22, not understand, it was not 3 weeks ago that we said, be ready for this, because this will be an opening for you that will be awesome. It truly, really will be awesome to be able to explain that. But again, they crucified the Lord of Guests. What does that mean? Does that mean that God's nature could be destroyed by man? Or that the God-man voluntarily gave his life, which is what can be crucified? That is, his physical body, his perfect human life, he gives voluntarily. And I realize many people would like to say, well, I just wish you could give a better illustration of it. It's unique. Nothing in this universe can give a perfect illustration of it. It's absolutely positively unique. And so if you could give an illustration from nature, then it wouldn't be unique. There's only been one incarnate one, and that was the God-man. As I mentioned the night before last, what got me into that? I was accordance. I was reading some of my early church stuff in Greek, and that phrase, theanthropos, the God-man. And I read from Ignatius, and I had a few people saying, you need to try. No, I'm just posting this stuff and commenting on it, and if I have to be doing all the rest of that stuff, then I won't post and comment on it, so I'd rather do it for a few than nobody at all. But anyway.
And this brings us to the final theological fallacy proposed by many Christian apologists.
Well, actually, fallacy is spelled with two L's, but we will skip over that.
Which is a claim that the death of God on the cross is no less insulting or diminishing to God's status than when Muslims dispose of the Quran by burning it.
Who they even talking to? I understand. I don't want to disrespect the Muslims that have put this together. Like I said, it was one of the better, very well done, graphically very well done, really communicates to young people today. And you know what? You probably have encountered some Christians that made these arguments. I get it. The death of God was a voluntary self-giving by them. That was the intention of Father, Son, and Spirit from eternity past. It was the very center point of history. It is the means by which God has been most glorified. Not, by any stretch of the imagination, something that is dishonoring to him. He didn't cease to exist. You don't believe death is the cessation of existence? It is the greatest act of self-giving, mercy, love, grace that the world will ever know. So, why a Christian would even think of making the parallel, I don't even begin to understand.
But the huge difference between the two concepts is that Muslims don't believe God is physically present in the Quran and experiences its burning. Whereas the Christian doctrine is solely based upon the point that God experienced the crucifixion. Because without that, there would be no sacrifice. And if we were to follow this line of thinking, then one might conclude that God only needed to send down his book to die instead of man. And then I guess we'd find churches filled with pictures and statues of Qurans on the cross instead of Jesus. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Quran. All humor aside though, I'll see that the whole premise of this argument is false, and is only propagated by people who have a shallow understanding of their own faith and theology. If you like this video and want to see more...
So there you go. I didn't comment too much about the end because it wasn't overly fun. And it didn't really make much sense, and it wasn't really a good way to stop. And they haven't done much else, but someone asked me to review it, so I wanted to review it. And that pretty much takes us to the end of the hour anyways. We want to try to respond to these things. I'm going to keep looking for... Man, I'm almost afraid to say this, but if you see interesting meme theology, go ahead and send it to me. That might help me out a little bit. Just because you post it to me doesn't mean I'm necessarily good, but if you see interesting meme theology, which is not memes about me, by the way, there are plenty of them. But it does seem to be that is how people are making their points these days. And I'm not trying to give in to the dumbing down logical discourse, because we did spend 45 minutes on only 4 memes. So we obviously are sort of rebelling against the dumbing down of theology by expanding upon that. But if you do see stuff that you think might be relevant to the program, go ahead and send it via Twitter and or Facebook, one of the two. And Twitter, Rich decided for the Twitter route at that point. Did you see how many people actually found the clothing to the technologically damaged dividing line?
Yes, apparently I have really bad accent there.
Well, I said it too. So yes. I think I might have gotten in. You all the weakest link. Come on. Right toward the end.
Yours is probably better than mine. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. But is that? I think that program's still on somewhere.
Yeah,
it's been a long time.
It's probably on the BBC.
Well, probably. Yes, yes. But anyway, apologies for our live streaming issues. We will keep working on them.
We endeavor to persevere.
Rich will not be able to go home until the... So next time you'll see him with a full beard because he will have... And he'll smell because he will not... have gone home until he got this whole thing fixed. Thanks for listening to the program today. Lord willing, we'll see you next week. God bless.